Hey guys, this is Tony Vicinda from The Threshold. Thank you guys for joining us for the second episode in our opening trilogy of episodes. All three of these are going to drop around the same time during the same week. Our hope is to give you just an insight into the scope of the podcast. Typically, I'm very against re-interviewing, but our opening audio for the first three podcasts just didn't come out the way we wanted it to. And I didn't want to ask my other guests to re-interview, but since I have unlimited access to Father Colin Parrish, I am forcing him to redo this interview so that we can give you guys the kind of audio quality we feel like you deserve. So I hope you guys enjoyed this podcast with Father Parrish, and we'll talk to you in just 1 second. In a time when religious conversations can seem tense or even taboo, I sit down each week with a different guest to talk about their beliefs, what shaped those beliefs, and why they really matter. My name's Tony Vicinda, and this is The Threshold. This week on The Threshold, I'm sitting down and talking with my good friend and co-host, Father Colin Parrish. We're talking about his experiences of faith, how he got to become a Catholic priest in the Archdiocese of Seattle, and really what it meant to him to grow up and embrace his own humanity and seeking out the beauty of the humanity of others. Let's talk about what really matters with Father Colin Parrish. So let's talk about two things before we get started.
Okay.
What do you want me to call you on the air? Because I know the rules for the rest of life. But what are our online rules?
Just call me Father Parrish or Father Colin or Father Colin Parrish.
Just one of those three?
Yeah.
Okay. So the other one is how do we feel about cussing? Because we know that
I love cussing. We know
that the first person to cuss on our podcast is going to be you.
Yeah. Oh man. So I'm going to try my best to not cuss, and if I do, I just hopefully it'll get bleeped.
I can only make so many promises. So, Father, would you just tell people a little bit about who you are? Kind of. Today was your first day of high school, right?
Mm-hmm. Today was my first. I just took a swig of whiskey straight from the bottle.
Tell people when I say your first day of high school, tell them a little bit about who you are and kind of what you're doing in the world right now.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah, my name is Father Colin Parrish. I'm a priest of the Archdiocese of Seattle. I've been ordained for like 3 months.
3 months.
Wow. No longer 2 months anymore. 3 months.
You could actually identify that as a fraction of a year. That could be a quarter of a year.
I have been ordained for a quarter of a year. I'll just say 3 months. I am the parochial vicar, which just means like associate guy, like lower level guy, priest at St. Luke in Shoreline, where I work with you.
Correct.
Where we are co-workers in the vineyard of the Lord. I am also a chaplain, Catholic or high school chaplain at Blanchett High School in Seattle.
And that started today. This was the first day of high school.
Yeah, besides last week's orientation with faculty, yeah.
So you actually got to see teenagers and teenagers saw you today.
Yeah, I kind of got scared a little bit.
On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the worst, 1 being the least, how scared were you?
Actually, it was really like a 3.
Okay. As a percentage, 0 being none at all, 100 being all of them, how many young people do you think you scandalized today?
By my smile?
By however you did it.
This just might be a lack of awareness, self-awareness. So I don't think that many.
You don't think that many? Like 3?
No, very little.
You keep on not saying none. So there's like 3, 1, or 2, or none.
Well, let me put it this way. I probably didn't scandalize any of the kids. I probably scandalized the faculty.
Awesome.
Which is what I do regularly.
Yeah.
So, that's my secondary role at the high school is to scandalize faculty.
Right.
I take pleasure in that. It's called Schadenfreude.
Can you tell people you didn't grow up a Catholic priest? Mm-mm. You weren't born a Catholic priest. You actually had kind of a different upbringing. Before we dive into that, could you maybe tell us kind of what are some of the things that you are passionate about in life?
That's my requisite. Let's talk about life sound.
All right.
What am I passionate about? Well, I'm passionate about my faith, which maybe goes, hopefully goes without saying, but I'm passionate about my faith, about my relationship with God. I'm passionate about music and listening to anything that is going to somehow, contribute to my humanity, right? Okay. Anything from listening to Trent Reznor or Johnny Cash to, even though I don't really listen to Trent Reznor too much, but to punk and, I don't know, reggae. Yeah.
If you were going to have one song that was like the background soundtrack to your life, like played overhead when you entered into rooms, what would that song be? Okay, played internally when you entered into rooms, what would that song be?
It would be Trucker's Atlas by Modest Mouse.
Okay. And you don't have an Out Loud song?
Yeah. It's called Power to Love by Jimi Hendrix and a Band of Gypsies.
All right. So what are some of the things that make you happy? Like what is
art.
A good art?
Art, sorry. Love art.
All right.
I'm passionate about art.
Any certain period, any certain style?
Yeah, the Vienna Secessionist, which is a very specific period of it was coming before abstract art. It was coming out of what's called the tradition. So they were like anti-romanticists, but they were still doing realistic art. So they had a lot of symbolism and allegory going into their art. So you see in a lot of like Art Deco buildings, or, you know, people from the East Coast would understand Art Deco more than the West Coast
right.
folk. I was really raised with that because of Seattle. So
cool. Tell me about some of the people you hang out with, some of the people who inspire you, who you find yourself attracted to, or that you just enjoy being around.
So I would say, what am I attracted to? I'm attracted to people who live life in an intense way. And I'm not talking about the guy who's, or the girl for that matter, who's just trying to get the adrenaline fix. Although there is a certain beauty in that. I can understand that. But intensely meaning that they go up in front of their life, every moment of it, and they're really looking to answer the question, what will make me happy and how do I live that? And so more often than not, these people are also trying to find out something that's true about reality and about life. And so people that are doing that is something that really moves me, attracts me, and people then finally that are kind of filled with a wisdom that's born from a difficult life. Right.
Is there someone, whether you know them in person or not, who you really kind of look up to as a role model?
I have a lot of role models. One of them is, she's going to be so embarrassed if I name her. My friend Mary Ellen in Washington, D.C.
All the Mary Ellens in Washington, D.C. are going to be mortified when they hear this.
Yes. She's somebody that really, a person I really follow. I mean, she's probably like my mom's age. Well, no, she's not my mom's age. She could be my mom. But she has, she's just tenacious with reality. But her affect when you're around her is she's kind of like a mouse. But that quickly burns away once you get to know her.
So it's kind of this quiet kind of intensity and desire that kind of, she seems very unassuming, mm-hmm. but in reality is deeply engaged.
Yeah, she's a tiger in front of life.
Cool. Anyone else?
They have to be alive?
No.
Oh, okay. A priest named Father Luigi Giussani, Monsignor Luigi Giussani, who's the founder of the movement that I belong to.
Which is?
Communion and Liberation.
If you describe Communion and Liberation in like 10 seconds or less, what would you say?
You're setting me up.
I am.
It's like Opus Dei for F-ups.
What if you had a little bit longer to explain CL? What would you tell people CL is?
CL is like, it's this movement that's born from an encounter with Christ that Giussani had, and this realization that he had about it was again another realization that Christ is meant to answer the human heart, and that the human heart desires so much and is so intense that it's always looking for something to answer it. And so what Giussani realized was that he wanted to kind of bring this into the schools or whatever in Milan. I'm giving a horrible description of it, but basically more or less in 10 seconds, it's meant to help the Christian mature in his or her own faith and to grow in familiarity with Christ, even into their flesh.
Okay. So really kind of learning how to incarnate Jesus in their lives in a very intentional way.
Yes. And it's done. And it has a lot of emphasis on beauty and art. Right. But Jasani was this guy that I'm attracted to because of his own way of recapitulating who Christ was, right? And like, what does it mean to be in the world? And what does it mean to find Christ in reality?
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about, if you had to, somebody came up to you on the street and they said, can you tell me in a minute or less what you believe, how you would respond to that person?
I believe that everything that the human heart that longs and desires for, looks for, longs after, yearns for, became flesh. Hmm. And that this, that in other words, that God, right, became a person, right, took on humanity, and that this person, this divine person, I have a relationship with, and that it saves me now in the sense of it vivifies my humanity. It brings me back to life at every moment, and is meant to bring me back to life at the end, like he did, because of his, and he's meant to help me gain a new identity, right? My true identity. And that it's done primarily through an unbreakable communion, an unbreakable communion of people, a body of people called the church. Hmm. And that this is what mediates the grace in the world, and the energy of God, right, is mediated through this body of people.
And they said, what religion are you?
Catholic. Yeah, I'm a Roman Catholic.
Yeah. That's, you know. No, I mean, those two things aren't always the same, right? I could ask any number of Catholics, and very few would have given, if any, would have given the response you just gave. There may have been some common or overlapping elements, but the nice thing is, and there are people who are going to hate this, like, because there are over a billion Catholics, there are over a billion ways that people experience mm-hmm. their Catholic identity and their Catholic faith, of whom a lot of it is not at all. And I say that not judgmentally, like, it doesn't have any significance to them. It doesn't provide value or meaning to their life. And for a vast number of people who it does, they would have given a different answer. So I love that. But again, like I said, you didn't come out of the womb a Catholic priest. So tell us a little bit about you growing up. What did faith life look like for you as a child?
I grew up in a, what I would call nominally secular family. All right. So it wasn't like some, you know, card carrying member of the, I don't know, secular
militia,
whatever. Yeah, I know.
They weren't militant atheists, or no, they weren't angry at the church. They just weren't anything.
Yeah. I mean, they were, so, you know, my grandparents didn't go to church. My parents didn't, my mom had fallen away from her childhood faith at that point, and was pretty agnostic. I was same with my father. And my family had kind of this, ethos of a vague Protestantism in their blood and their background. And there were some vestiges that were left, like my grandfather teaching me how to pray before bed so that I wouldn't die, stuff like that. It was actually a really beautiful prayer. I love it.
Do you remember it?
Now I lay me down to sleep. I usually fell asleep after that. I can't remember that part.
I pray the Lord my soul to keep. And if I die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. Which is a terrifying prayer if you think about it, but it's a beautiful sentiment that he would desire that you be taken by God if you... Yeah, but yeah, it's a terrifying prayer to teach your children.
Yeah. I was never scared of it.
I don't think kids ever are. It's when you think about it as an adult when you're like, wait.
Yeah.
So nominally secular, some vestigial Protestantism in there. Were you baptized?
I was baptized at Magnolia First Presbyterian in Seattle as a kind of a Pascal's Wager.
Right. What's Pascal's Wager for those who are listening and might not know?
Pascal's Wager is basically, more or less, it means that if... you know, if God exists and you have faith, or you make that leap, whatever you want to call that, then you will be saved, right? If God does not exist and you still make that leap, you'll at least look like a fool and nothing will happen.
Right.
So it's like you're going to win anyway.
Right. I can either be a fool for 30 minutes and nothing is lost, or God is real and therefore my child's going to enter into eternity, which is, you know, it's a reason a lot of people have their child baptized, or their grandparents talk them into having their children baptized in any number of Christian denominations to this day. Right.
Yeah.
And so, cool. So nominally secular, baptized. What was your religious experiences growing up? Did you have any sort of religious influences?
I did. Yeah. I went to, I'm an only child, and so my parents could afford it. I went to Catholic schools, and And some that was actually really pretty important for me because I'm going to Holy Days of Obligation, which are basically days that Catholics go to Mass that are not Sunday, or required to go to Mass that are not on Sundays. So that would be during the school week, you know, and going to like Stations of the Cross on Fridays during Lent and looking at the pictures in the books and the statues on the walls of the Passion, looking at the tabernacle where the presence of God resides in the Eucharist, thinking like, how the hell does God fit in that box? And I just kind of want to be there in that tiny box and a tiny person with him.
It was wow.
That was my thoughts as a child.
I love the way kids think about that kind of stuff, right? The way that literalism and abstractions meet each other in religiosity are super,
super awesome. Yeah. I love that too. I still remember those thoughts, but I had some, so that really formed me. It made me, I felt like it was just very normal.
Are there any people that had an impact on you religiously as a child besides your family?
I mean, my, this lady, I don't know who she was. I was in first grade and I remember she came in to tell us, it was after Easter, and she came in to tell us about, her, this friend of hers that she knew, and his name was Jesus. And, you know, you're a 6-year-old, you know, 7-year-old first grader. You're pretty open to most anything. And you're like, all right, tell me about this guy. And she told us the story of Zacchaeus and the sycamore tree from Luke 9. And anyway, where Zacchaeus, you know, is this horrible dude who's he's a tax collector, which meant he was stealing from everybody in the town. And anyway, the short dude climbs up on a tree and looks at, and Jesus is coming through the town. And Jesus sees this guy looking at him from the crowds, above the crowds in this tree, because see how short he was. And he says, Zacchaeus, I want to come to your house tonight. I want to have dinner with you. And this totally changed Zacchaeus' whole life. That was the first time I ever heard the gospel. And I was just like totally, like I had a religious experience around that.
Now, I know last time you shared it very openly. And I'm going to be very honest. If you don't try to reshare it, I'm going to edit that other clip back in. So what was your response to that?
Well, I mean, I was coming from, yeah, I know. I mean, redoing the interviews is difficult because I'm like, I really liked the last interview.
It was really good. And I, like I said, you were really nervous actually about sharing this story from the original interview.
I was, yeah.
Because you thought it would be too intense for an opening episode. I have faith in our listeners. What was your response to that? Well, how did you respond as an individual to that?
I had a really, the background around it was the fact that I was suffering severely, and my family were in difficult situation with each other, and my parents weren't doing well, and so there was just a lot of turmoil in my family. And I'm a feeler, right? So I feel everything, and I take it in. I'm trying to process it, hold it, whatever. Even as a child, and I was very self aware as a child. It's part of my personality, and I was being bullied at school. Just all the time. And I just felt I was in a very, very, very dark place. And it's kind of embarrassing to share those kinds of details. So, but you know, I mean, I was depressed and suicidal as a child. Right. And it's possible. You just, anyway, anybody you can Google like that kind of stuff, it happens. But when that story happened, when she told us that, you know, that encounter of Zacchaeus and Jesus, just had this really intense moment where, you know, the room kind of, nothing else was really existing. And there's just this very deep awareness of a voice saying, you are Zacchaeus. And what that meant, what that was translated into, as far as my understanding, I still remember it was, is that, that you're not too small to be noticed, or you're not insignificant. You know, like the crap that you go through is not insignificant. And so you're not alone, right? Like there's a presence with you. And anyway, so it had nothing to do with my like sin or like, right. You know, I wasn't robbing people of, right. You know, it was not condemnatory whatsoever. It was like a deep communion of love. And
from that story, it's the looking up, right? It's the Jesus stopping under the tree, having no reason to look up and seeing this person, but really seeing them and saying, I see you and you have value.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so, and that changed everything for me in that moment. And for the, and so what I was not suicidal after that. Started having thoughts of charity, right? Like probably shouldn't kill myself because my mom might be unhappy with that.
Right.
To put it, you know, crassly.
Right.
With these people that were bullying me, I just decided that I would receive the bullying, right, and make it a prayer for them, offer it in some way for them that they would never do that again for other people.
So you basically became a perfect living saint, is what you're saying at that moment in time.
Yeah, but I mean, I was 6 or 7. I mean, I wasn't at the age of reason. So
it didn't last very long, is also what you're saying. So let's flash forward a little bit. You went to a local Catholic high school, O'Day. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about what your high school life was like, as you kind of did hit that age of understanding reason, yeah, had many more moral realities and things enter into your life. What was that like?
Yeah, you know, I was just an awkward kid. Some would say I still am. I was not socially adept whatsoever. I mean, that kind of stuff I learned in the Navy out of survival. So sometimes, like, I really relate with kids that are individuals who are on the autism spectrum, where they have to, like, learn social traits, you know, and things to do and mimic that. I totally kind of get that. I had to do that, even though I'm not on the spectrum. So anyway, but I was awkward and socially inept. I was in the punk and emo scene a lot, so I never really had friends at my high school, but I was really good at sports, particularly soccer. I played in varsity starting freshman year, and I was on state teams for other things.
Did that experience of being on a team, was there any sort of significance to that? Did that mean anything?
It was just this big experience of absence.
Yeah.
Because, oh man, dude, I hated being around these soccer players, man. They were just, ugh. Anyway, so I wasn't really open to them either. Right. So I was kind of, you know, and I was also like, you know, liked women a lot, right? I was really, you know, once puberty hit, right, and I found out that that women were some kind of existential option for my pain, like, oh great, like that's the shiz, honestly. So I'll go for that.
Yeah,
so I really went deep there, and that was super painful. Right, and that lasted throughout part of my Navy career as well, and after high school.
Now, you did convert in high school to being Catholic, right?
Yeah, so I was, which is a confusing part of my story that I don't often tell people because it's just so strange.
I just found out, like, I mean, when we originally did this interview, like a day before, now it's been a few weeks. I'm still trying to wrap my head around how you lied to me for a year and a half.
Well, you know, like having been a self-aware kid, it was just part of my personality, being deeply aware of my desire, my need for fulfillment, for the searching for meaning, was always a big part of my life. You know, a lot of that was also done through the relational realm, right? And, you know, looking for meaning through relationships, which isn't like, that's a pretty reasonable method.
Right.
But anyway, I had this experience of, you know, growing up in the family I grew up in, they were mostly Scandinavian, of Scandinavian descent. And my grandfather was an only child. My dad's an only child. I'm an only child. So on the parish side of things, you know, we were pretty low batting average. But on the women's side of things, there's always like tons of siblings. And my grandma was one of 10. And, she, you know, all of my childhood experience of family was really centered around my grandma's family. And my grandfather was friends with all her siblings, right? Everybody was really close. They knew how to live life together. They were quite close, even if they suffered from what I would say is kind of like a, you know, a very intense consumerism and American secular, consumerism. You know, the good life is meant by having things and
buying things,
having a good job, having a comfortable life, right? They never really had meaning questions in their conversations that I was aware of. But anyway, a lot of my identity was around this family. And so, you know, they're all old, and none of their children really had kids, right? And so when that generation, my grandma's generation, started dying off, a lot of the fabric of my meaning and my identity really started to splinter deeply, right? And so I went searching. I'm like, well, what can give me this thing? And I was going to become a Jew. I was thinking, like, well, what happened for me was I was like, well, I got to find some kind of identity and meaning, which every teenager asks.
Yeah. Right. Every person asks.
Yeah, every person asks, and especially teenagers, right? It's just very visceral in your face, which is the beauty of being a teenager, one of the few beauties of being a teenager. I thought, well, every adult, which is naive and beautiful at the same time, every adult has a religion, right?
Right.
You know, so I should have a religion, right? I should have some kind of belonging. I grew up with Jews around me, a lot of Jews around me in Seattle, oddly enough, like, and, or at least I can remember a lot of relationships with people who were identified as Jews.
It's one of the local religious populations that does easily self-identify. Like, people don't talk about faith in Seattle, but because Judaism is also a cultural identity, it transcends that kind of don't talk about it barrier, because it's their identity. I mean, through and through. And so it's one of the beautiful things about Judaism. Oh, yeah.
So I always felt like the sense of community with them. And I was like, I really want to become a Jew because of that. So I just, the only reason I didn't, was because I was like, well, my mom's not a Jew, which is a thing.
It's right? How you're a Jew.
It's how you're a Jew. Yeah. And I'm like, well, I'll only be like kind of like a half breed. And so, and I was like, still love them, and but maybe not, and then I didn't really want to consider Protestantism too much because of my family's kind of vague Protestant background. And then I didn't want to become Buddhist, but he asked me about that, and I didn't want to do that because, you know, for me the first tenet of one of the primary tenets of Buddhism is that desire is the source of all suffering. Right. And
which is, I actually want to say, for me, that was actually one of the biggest attractions to Buddhism in high school.
Really?
Was because all of my suffering came from things I wanted and couldn't have. And I, by that, I mostly mean girls I wanted to date or things I wanted to do that I shouldn't be doing. So I really was conflating like desire with something that is not really good desire or healthy desire as all desire. But that was actually one of my attractions, was like, yeah, everything I want brings me pain. And it was a very confused reverse Paul statement of like, I don't want what's good for me, and I don't even know that, but I really want it, so maybe I just shouldn't want things. Right.
For me, I just wanted everything, and I was very okay with wanting everything.
Yeah.
And I still am okay with wanting everything.
Oh, I obviously didn't go the Buddhist route. Yeah. Like, I realized why that doesn't work, but
no, totally. That's another threshold conversation.
Let's talk about that. When we get a Buddhist on here, we'll talk about it.
And but anyway, I just, for me, it's like my desire was one of the few things that I had that was intact still, right? Out of all the pain of my family and the suffering that I was going through, all the broken relationships that I created with women, right? Like, desire was the one thing that I still had, right? That was, I knew that was true about me. All the falseness that I had experienced and all the falseness that I imposed upon people, desire was the only thing that was still really true. And so I said no to that, and then I just realized that crap, I've been going to Catholic schools my whole life pretty much, and there's things you can easily identify Catholics with, statues and religious paraphernalia and whatever, gestures, color, art, whatever. So I thought, well, I'll become Catholic because, you know, I was really looking for an identity, right? Because of the lack of family one. And so I just wanted something that I could put on, you know, my and a hospital card and my dog tags. Just wanted that RC on there just to have this identity. So I didn't really care about Jesus whatsoever, but I was intent on it. So I joined RCIA when I was 17, which is like the process, the rite of Christian initiation for adults, which is the process for becoming Catholic.
Which is one of the worst branded and named programs in the church.
I know.
Period.
It will have a resurrection. Anyway.
All things do. So then you join the Navy, right? So you go into the Navy.
Yeah.
Why the Navy?
Because I was also a horrible, horrible student. And that was the other thing is that, just for example, you know, no one was really, you know, I'm still kind of mad at my high school at that. Don't hate me, guys. I love my high school, but I was kind of mad at them for this. But no,
you work at a different high school now. You've obviously abandoned them fully. So
that's not what I got assigned. No, but anyway, so they, you know, no one really. I did poorly in school because no one was really engaging me on these really big questions of existence, right? Like, why do I need a good job, right? They always say, well, you need a good job so you can, you know, have a stable life and da-da-da-da. I'm like, well, okay, I get a house and then I get a wife or whatever and then I die. So great. So I just, you know, I didn't do well in school because I just didn't see any point in doing well in school, especially because it was hard, right? So it's a little bit of a cop-out, right?
So you don't do well in school because of that. You go into the Navy.
Yeah, and I was also wanted to get away from my family. I wanted to just, I needed to just get out of Dodge. But I knew I needed to learn discipline and work ethic. And I just needed, and I didn't think that I could do that on my own. Knew I couldn't go to college because I was so unvirtuous and just, you know, I just would have gotten a girl pregnant, would have become an alcoholic or a drug addict or all three. at once. You know, I mean, it's like that would have been, I'm a man of the flesh.
Right.
And
you, the cover art for this episode is going to be the picture that I took of you yesterday.
I am a man of habit, just not the good ones.
Right. So in the Navy, you were a fireman, right? Yeah. Which involved like crawling into small spaces on a boat, inhaling toxic fumes and putting out fires, right?
Yeah.
And you also, during that time, had a conversion of heart too. So,
yeah.
So talk about that a little bit.
So I was having this, I left from the Navy, went to boot camp, whatever, about a year in, I had found myself in this kind of, relationship with a woman and it just wasn't really healthy. It was based on all the things that were, it shouldn't primarily be based on. So she ended up wisely breaking up with me. Right. And I remember she was visiting family and in San Diego, and her family was lived on a hill overlooking Tijuana on the American side. And she broke up with me outside of her family's apartment. And then she just walked back inside and she was like, see ya. And I just remember looking out over the vast expanse of human suffering that is Tijuana and finally realizing that I was in despair, right? Like that. I had lived a lot of my high school experience, 4 years previous, including the whole year in the Navy, just really in despair, right? And not knowing it. And so there's a Walker Percy quote that's, talking about meaning, saying like, or being on the search, a man who is on the search is onto something, and not to be onto something is to be in despair. Well, I at least found out at that point that I was in despair. And so next day I left for my first deployment and we're on the ocean and just realized I needed to talk to somebody. And I thought, well, because I'm a Catholic, ostensibly, right?
It's on your dog tags.
It's on my dog tags. I made my profession of faith, received confirmation, right? I should talk to a priest. We happen to have a priest on the ship. And so I didn't really want to sign up to see him, right? I didn't want that kind of, stigma, whatever. So I looked at the religious schedule of the ship, the public schedule, and I was trying to figure out what is a place where I could encounter the priest where no one would be, right? How could I corner the guy, in other words? So at the very end of each night, there on the list, it said 9 p.m. Catholic rosary, right? And I was like, well, crap, if I knew the Catholics I grew up with, they would never go to rosary. And so I showed up, it was just him and I, sure enough, and I just introduced myself briefly and said I had some questions. I was wondering if I could talk to him, and he said, well, we're here publicly, so we got to pray the rosary. He says, do you know how to pray the rosary? I said, no. So he taught me how to pray the rosary, prayed the rosary. We went back to his office afterward, and I was just blown away by this guy. I don't remember what he said. I remember just talking about my life. And I just remember there's something so inexorably different about him in such a beautiful way. So I wanted to verify. All right. So I was like, well, I'm going to see him tomorrow. And I didn't really want to ask for another appointment. So I just said to myself, I'll just show back up to Rosary and just kind of get through it and then meet with him after. So I did it. It was the same experience the next day. And did a third time, same thing. And I just kind of kept meeting with him in this way for every day for 3 months. Right. And it was just over the course of these meetings where he'd meet with me for an hour, maybe two each night, right, until like 11 or midnight. I just went deeper and deeper into my questions. Right. And he really pulled out and helped delineate and distinguish and challenge or affirm, whatever. Right. I really cannot remember the content of any of these conversations, but at the end of it, what I do remember is just this realization that, holy crap, I cannot imagine being separated from a love that's loving me like this. And I knew that it wasn't his love alone, right? There was a deep awareness that there was a different love here, right? And we had been talking about heaven and hell, and he gave me a great definition of hell. And it was that hell is God ratifying your decision to be separated from him, right? And I was like God respecting your freedom,
right?
And I was like, oh, right? And I realized that's when I made the connection. That, and also I realized that, like, some things about my parents, well, that's not important at the moment, but that'll be a tangent. And I just said, I went in kind of a stupor for like 3 days, because he also had to leave the ship to go say mass on some of the other ships in our fleet. And I just couldn't think of anything else but like trying to be inside, trying to be in belonging, wanting to be in belonging and communion, and not wanting to be left out and excluded because of my own decision, right? Like not wanting to exclude myself, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Because no one's excluding me, right? I'm the one who's been doing this. So I just went back, and when he got back on the ship 3 days later, I was just like, I'm on him, right? It's like, hey, you know, how do I do this, right? And he says, you know, have faith in, you know, belief, the gift of faith, you know, following the commandments of the church and her precepts and what she teaches. And I was like, I'll do it. So I had a really, I did a lifelong confession after that. I felt like a butterfly. I became understandable to myself for the first time, right? I could understand my humanity finally and the beauty of it. And the brokenness of it as well, but the fact that like it's more beautiful than it is broken,
right?
Much more beautiful than it is broken, even if the brokenness is deeply wounding and important. But it's, you know, daily mass, kept going to rosary. I had another religious experience that was very confirming for me, of recognizing that, you know, there's someone drawing me here. There's a person.
Yeah. So let's talk about that real quick. So. You seem to obviously believe that a relationship with God is possible.
Mm-hmm.
And you believe you have a relationship with God?
Yes.
And, you've described it all a lot, so I don't want to make you recap that, but you have experienced, that relationship directly and intimately over the course of your life in a number of ways. Is that correct?
Yes.
I'm doing way more recapping right now because we've already done this interview once.
I want to point out really to people. I really liked my answer on that one too.
Well, I do too, but you also kind of refuse to answer, right? So you've had some of these deep encounters with God, but they're not necessarily things you would be willing to share.
Well, it's just the question about being willing to share is just because it's so personal in the sense of, you know, like, I don't know, with your wife, like, you know, there's some kinds of pillow talk that,
right,
it's just for you two.
There are certain places where my wife gets really upset when I talk about our sex life.
Yeah, right. You know, so, and you know, by analogy, you know, in my relationship with Christ, it's not that I just don't like sharing it super publicly because I mean I don't hide it from friends,
right?
Right, and I do talk about it eventually, but it's just that it's really, it's a kind of intimacy for me that is.
Sharing it needs to be significant and matter, not just because we want to have a good conversation on a podcast.
Yeah, and also there's in context is context is really important, right? So I mean, there are things that you and your wife talk about that are taken out of the context of your love would be totally would seem either from different angles irrational, violent, impersonal, strange, whatever, but it's because someone's not seeing it from within the context of your relationship of love.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm always a little not wanting to put it out there too much.
Tell me about, like, is your faith something that you practice every day, and how, like, you as a Catholic priest, what does your practice of faith look like?
I try to practice every day.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Let's be more specific. What does your prayer life look like?
My prayer life. So, I mean, my prayer life revolves around the liturgy, which for our non-Catholic friends, liturgy is a set of rituals that are, the people and the priests are doing together. And it's like kind of like almost like there's a dialogue and a response that's going on. But within that, the author of that work is Christ himself doing it. And so it's this kind of indwelling and or inpouring of the energy of God into the world, into these people, right? And it's done through this very human and fleshy, tangible experiences. And so a lot of my prayer will happen there. And then, yeah, what else?
What are the types of prayer you do?
So I also do what's called a liturgy of the hours, which are all 150 psalms in a four-week cycle that you say at five different periods throughout the day, or that I'm required to say five for five periods. There's actually seven of them, but 7 hours of those, seven periods of those that you do, but I'm only required to do five. And so I'm praying the Psalms a lot. And then I do a lot of, prayer with scripture, which revolves around me sitting down with a piece of scripture from either the Old Testament or the New Testament and putting, you know, speaking to the Lord about it, and pretty much like just about putting myself in the scene, using imaginative prayer, and speaking about like the good, bad, the ugly of my heart, right? All the things that I don't want to talk about, I talk about all the things that I want to talk about. I do. And I just notice all these thoughts, feelings, and desires that I have, and I relate them to him. And then I, you know, I just see how the scene changes, or I just, a lot of the time I'm just like speaking extemporaneously to him when I'm walking around, because like my prayer can be so crappy in this transition period that,
I just know the crappiness of personal experience and how that influences just kind of continual prayer dialogue with God. I wasn't trying to comment on your crappiness.
No, that's fine if you do. And so my, you know, my prayer will often be like me listening, right? Saying something, just speaking directly from my heart as I'm walking down the sidewalk or I'm smoking. And then, you know, I'll be thinking about something that's a piece of art or a piece of scripture that resonated with me that I heard from the liturgy. And then I'll, you know, and then he'll say something, he'll give me an image about it. And, you know, I see this surprising new growth in me, or growth meaning like the solidity in me that I didn't experience before. And it's usually mediated through what I call the voice of my conscience. So it sounds like my voice.
Yeah. Right? And that was going to be my next question. So how do you, like, you know, we talked about the relationship with God being a lot like a relationship with a spouse or a friend or a loved one, right? In those situations, ideally that person's responding to you. So how Christ responds to you through the voice of your conscience, and what other ways? Are there other ways?
Yeah. And also through friendships that I have and experiences of reality that I have a very deep trust and belief in the fact that, that Christ is in reality. Like he's not, because God is not part of reality of the created world. That means he can be in everything at the same time. He's not bound to it, so he can be present to everything, right? He doesn't have to be present to one thing. He can be present to everything. And so it means he allows things to happen in reality, and that I live my life, all the experiences of my reality, as a critical dialogue with him. Like, okay, whether it be like from Jeremiah, like, you duped me.
Opening this week, right?
Yeah, I'm pissed off at you. I think you're right, but I don't want to do this. Or like, I think you're right, and I won't do this, at least for now, because I'm pissed off at you. Or I want to do this, or, you know, whatever. He speaks through these circumstances that make a question arise in my heart. And that question that arises in my heart, I tell him about.
If you had to describe what it means to be Catholic to somebody else, what would you tell them? What does it mean to be Catholic?
So, like, you know, look, the fathers of the church, okay, I'm just love quoting this. I love going on this tack, but the church fathers, right? Like, I'm thinking of Gregory of Nyssa. They really, like, they never made the distinction between good and bad when it came to people, right? It's not like you're good or you're bad, because that distinction is too arbitrary, because it's a sliding scale that moves, depending on culture, time, whatever, value systems. They always describe the human person, made the judgment about the human person between sick and well. So those who are well are the saints, those who experience communion with God. The sick are those who are experiencing healing or on the process of healing, but they still need it, right? And those are usually us, even if we're on this road of healing. So, which I like, I love that definition, because it's subjective, right? But it's organic.
Right. And it's not that Jesus came to make bad people good. He came to make sick people well.
Exactly. And so, and it also means that there's a critical, like, in order to be well, I have to live. I have to live with someone. I can't be well on my own. And so the point being with this is that, what does it mean to be Catholic? Is, for me, I would describe it as the experience of going, like, being in relationship with God, with the Holy Trinity, right, and receiving his love through the sacraments, through these, you know, privileged instantiations of the intensity of his love, and being in communion with these other people that are part of his body, right, and that receiving his divine love through these people. Right. So it's all, what does it mean to be Catholic? And that, you know, and that there's a hierarchy, like and it's like a hierarchy of authoritativeness, right? I need somebody authoritative that I can trust, that I can receive trust, love trustfully with,
somebody who you can entrust like yourself to and receive love from.
Yes. And that happens, you know, that happens in the Catholic Church. The last thing I was going to say is that, and what does it mean to be Catholic, to be, I would say for Christian, just Christian, but Catholic, is the whole point of this thing is learning how to receive love well, right? To see, truly receive love well, fully, with just to be able to say yes to receiving love.
So using the analogy that you love, right? On a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being dead, 10 being perfectly healthy, where are you at? Ooh.
Gosh, man, I'm pretty much on a 4.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's been a good week, because I think last time you said 3.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I hot damn. yeah, you know, I don't see myself anywhere above a 5.
It's good for people to hear that. Like, I think a lot of times we hear people who have this deep sense of intimacy with God, or who seem very spiritual in whatever capacity, and we sometimes think, why do they have this and I don't, right? And I think it's good to know that no matter what we may see on the outside, no matter how we may perceive people, you know, in our religious tradition, there's this extreme experience of God continually using people who are at stage 0, 1, and 2 to show everybody his power. He's rarely ever trying to shine through those who are just like, I'm fine all the time. I'm good. I live at this perfectly healthy state of being. And because those people are self-sufficient. And so,
yeah. And so that's the thing, like, that's the thing about, if there's one thing that, of the many things that you want, that somebody could understandably have issues with being Catholic or with the church or whatever, right? One thing that we're not is a religion of appearances. All right. I mean, we're more or less pretty comfortable with sinners. You know, and I mean, our first Pope denied Jesus 3 times.
Right.
For example,
those were his job qualifications. I mean, yeah, basically,
he had an impetuous love that was not founded in, whatever. So, and then the other thing that is attracts me is this reality of the fact that being Catholic, this is not a project of growing autonomy, right? Like Jesus didn't come to fix me. He didn't come to make me more autonomous, right? To make me
more self-sufficient.
More self-sufficient. Yeah. Right. He came to make me dependent. And that's what I love. Right. I love because that's what I very much dislike about being American.
Right.
And I love being about, I mean, people say, you're one of those Catholics that's like, you know, extremely, extremely Catholic. Well, depends on what you mean, but yes. I mean, it's because like,
I mean, I'm extremely bad at being Catholic, then yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah. Somebody asked me, like, what kind of Catholic are you? I'd just say I'm the bad one.
Awesome, man. So the last two things I want to just talk about before maybe we take a short little break, and then I'm going to tell you what I love about what you just told me. Is there a question you would want to ask me live on the air in front of everybody?
What does fruitfulness look like to you?
Yeah, that's like such a me question. You can't, what is fruitfulness in a certain context?
Fruitfulness in,
because otherwise I'm going to self-define it. I want to answer your question.
Fruitfulness. Oh man, I mean it probably just in the broad sense.
Okay, so because I talk a lot about fruitfulness, especially lately, because a lot of times I think there's a mistake between success and fruitfulness, right?
Yes. Yes.
And they're not contradictory towards each other, but they don't also overlap. So I think that things are successful when they meet certain quantifiable metrics. I think fruitfulness is far more qualitative than that. And I think fruitfulness really has to be very literally that which sustains us, right? Success actually doesn't sustain us. Success might make us happy. Success might make us look good. But at the end of the day, success doesn't sustain us. Fruitfulness is something that gives us sustenance, right? Really, I mean, very literally.
Yeah.
When a tree is fruitful, it provides for us. We are able to eat. We are able to thrive. And a tree can be successful at growing and not bear fruit.
Yeah.
It can be the biggest tree in the forest and not bear any kind of fruit. Fruitfulness is really about that. And I would express that for me personally very much in the fruit of charity, which I think is not the foundational virtue that I would necessarily express, but it is the supreme one that I would express, right? So charity in the sense of how do I provide fruit, not just for my own journey, but for the journey of others around me. If this podcast never achieves success numerically, I'll be pridefully devastated, but who cares? If there's good conversations that are happening, even just with the people that I'm sitting down to have interviews with, I'll feel like that is very fruitful. And that's where I draw sustenance for the journey from.
Awesome.
And then my other last thing is, would you be okay if I prayed with you? And if the answer is no, that's totally okay.
No. yes, go ahead.
All right.
Just don't touch me.
I'm gonna lay hands on Catholics right now.
Oh man, I can't. The Catholics will just touch everybody.
Oh man, I made a note earlier about what I was gonna say, and now I'm trying to remember what it was. Oh yeah, now I remember. Okay. Good and gracious God, we just desire to step into your presence more deeply, more fully right now, and I just thank you for Father Colin Parrish. For the blessing that he is in entering into this this podcast with me, for him sharing and letting us get to know each other better, but also for his desire to not be sick, for his desire to be well. And I know that there are often times where I feel like you'd lay things on my heart to tell those around me. And I know that I've had the experience of being able to share some of that with him, but I really am excited to have him as a companion on this journey as we enter into conversations about what significance, about what gives people wellness and life, about the goodness and the truth and the beauty that he is captivated by in his daily life. He sees so much beauty in the people and in the world around him, and I would ask that I am given just a glimpse of what the world must look like for him. I ask you to bless us and keep us through Christ our Lord.
Amen.
Amen. So if you want to get in touch with Father Parrish, the best way is actually going to be at thresholdpodcast.fm. You can find some of his social media information there. Also, the ability to email either one of us through that. So please feel free to check that out. And we're going to be back in just 1 minute at the end of each
Smoke
Threshold
break.
Podcast. I actually take a minute to sit down typically with Father Parrish, but this time I'm just going to say stuff to him and talked about what people took away from the experience, what he heard, what I heard. And then in the future, we'll have the opportunity for you guys to share about what you took away from the conversation as well. So I'm looking forward to that conversation in just 1 minute. Typically, after I sit down and interview somebody, I actually am joined by Father Parrish at this point, where we just kind of talk a little bit about what we took away from the experience of talking to that person, what I got out of talking to them, what stood out, what resonated with me. And then Father Parrish, having listened to that interview ahead of time, what really stood out to him? And this is something that I think is essential with any of these type of conversations, is that they should be personal. They should be direct in the context of a one-on-one conversation. But what we believe, though it may be deeply personal, really the belief isn't that it should be private. And so the ability to dialogue around it, to talk about it, and to name what we got out of that experience really helps affirm the other person, but also really helps ground what that person said in our own personal experience and help us to know a little bit more intentionally what we got out of that, what it meant to us, what it signified. And so now Father Parrish has to sit here and listen while I talk about why I love him so dang much.
Crap.
I just do want to express that I get a lot of beatitude out of mine and Father Parrish's friendship. We became good friends when he was a seminarian at the parish. It was before we knew he would be assigned here as a priest. It was before we had, you know, thought, hey, we may do a podcast together one day. He was just a somewhat awkward seminarian who wandered into my office for a 10-minute conversation that then took 4 or 5 hours. And so I just, I do get just a whole lot of blessing. And if you don't believe in that, I get a whole lot of goodness out of my relationship with Father Parrish. He's the kind of guy who I love having over for a beer at the end of the night and just decompressing, talking about our day. And as somebody who's worked for the church for most of my adult life, it's a rare situation where I actually have an adult male friend at the church who's not also a parishioner. And so it is just a huge blessing for me, and I'm really excited to be going on this journey with him. Anytime we talk about faith, right, I am always just kind of blown away really by the sincerity with which you see beauty in people and in things. And I know I talked about that a little bit as I was praying, but it's something that I think is really unique. I think a lot of people today are deeply attracted to the concept of truth, right? I know for me, the transcendental of goodness, right? Like taking care of other people, being good to other people, and not in a meaningless way, but in a significant way, that is something that is deeply attractive for me. But for you, it always seems like beauty really is at the heart of what causes you to pursue things. Is that something that you think is true?
Actually, beauty and truth.
Yeah.
Yeah, truth. You know, the I think a really good way that I've heard it put is that that the apex of beauty, the height of beauty is truth, right? And or the apex of truth is beauty,
right?
And so when I see something that's beautiful, I think, well, damn, that's true. And when I have a really deep experience of truth, whether it be relationally with friends or in nature or through art or science, and like geophysics, I love geology. I have a wonder in front of it, the beauty of this truth.
Yeah. And I think the important thing is really for a lot of these things that we would call transcendentals, right? Goodness, truth and beauty, Trudy, as I like to call two of them combined, is that they're not oppositional to each other, right? They collaborate in perfection with each other. And so, but I always am just kind of amazed by, you know, whenever you're like talking about one of your friends, somebody whether I've met them or not, or somebody who you just meet on the sidewalk, who you maybe had a chance encounter with, one of the things you'll often start talking about is just why that person was beautiful to you. Like why that person signified beauty to you. And then I'll meet some of these people and they're not what the world would think of as beautiful, right? They're just, not that they're unattractive necessarily, but it's not necessarily like people would say that as the primary word, but you just have this way of engaging with things where that's a deep reality that you quickly enter into. And I'm just always amazed by that. I think that comes across really clearly. I also just, you talking about your experience as a 7-year-old and really how you were able to kind of take this this experience with this religious encounter, right? And this experience of being bullied and how those two things interacted with each other, the way that kind of reshaped those experiences and gave them purpose and significance was pretty amazing, right? I think that's pretty impressive just that was an experience you were able to have, because I think very often those things aren't because of some amazing capability or adult capacity that we would have. It's just the way that we happen to respond to them because of a lot of pressures that we couldn't necessarily identify even. And so I just think that's such a beautiful experience. And then also just you were talking earlier about the relationship kind of between beauty and brokenness, right? And I'm not somebody who ever wants to glorify brokenness, right? But I do think that there's a reality that lots of times those things actually aren't just, they're not oppositional, that they actually cooperate with each other. Like part of the beauty comes from the brokenness, right? And we can see how it maybe was supposed to be, and that in the kind of putting back together of things, that there's a new beauty that kind of takes on in the sense of the beauty of like tracing the scar lines like along a lover's shoulder, right? Or the beauty of, you know, seeing like ancient structures that have kind of dilapidated and been repaired and then dilapidated again. I think those things are intrinsically connected to each other. And those were the things that stood out to me when you were talking. So I just want to kind of offer that to you.
Thank you. I received that.
Yeah. So let's talk for a second just about ways that people can connect with us. This is a new venture, a new project we're working on. I have a vision for where I'd like this to go. Like I would love for us to do this. You know, I'd love to be doing 40 episodes a year, taking a little bit of time off, basically doing a couple seasons in essence a year for the next 3 to 5 years. Like I would love for that to be the body of work and then to just kind of reevaluate at the end of that time. But right now in the very beginning stages, really, it's just us sitting in a room chatting, right? This beautiful purple room that I know you love.
I think you're talking about your wife.
So much, right?
This purple woman.
This purple woman who's sitting here on her MacBook while we talk. This beautiful purple woman in my basement, and having good conversations with people. I don't know where it's going to go, but I do want to be intentional about inviting people into things. So a couple ways, if you're interested in being able to connect with us, there's our Facebook page, facebook.com/thethresholdpodcast. There's also our website, which really houses everything, thresholdpodcast.fm. And there's ways on there that you can, you can listen to episodes, you can connect on how you download episodes on your preferred podcast listener, iTunes, any of the weird ones that Android and Google phones have, which I don't know what they are. I think Stitcher is one of them. And somebody told me, like, Pod Cafe, that they were able to download us on Pod Cafe earlier today and we're in their queue, which was really exciting. There's a lot of ways to do that. There's also a support button on there, which connects to our Patreon, and that's at thresholdpodcast.fm/support. I want to talk a little bit about what we're going to put on there, like what's on our Patreon. We have one amazing Patreon supporter, Sue, who is just an awesome person from California who randomly kind of stumbled across my preparation for this and really wants to support us. I'm really thankful to her for the first person to do that.
I hope your house is not burning in the wildfires.
So we're going to do a couple different things. So there's some low levels, which are basically just ways to show support. There's Patreon specific content. The one we put up last time was Father Perry, or me talking about one of my favorite youth ministry awkward saint stories that has to do with the patron saint of prostitutes. And then Father Parrish sharing what we're going to call sea stories, I believe.
Sea stories. Every sailor has them, and they're delicious.
So he responded to my story about the patron saint of prostitutes with one of his sea stories, and we put that up at the, I think, $5 and higher level. And then at $10, we really want to be able to send you guys stuff. We really want you guys to be able to experience kind of...
Now I make stuff for them, right?
Some beauty stuff. So Father Parrish is actually going to be, he's going to be drawing some visual reflections based on that. Some of that will become digital art. Sometimes one of my team members over at Project YM, Johnny, will make some graphic art for us. I know that the first one we're going to do with that, we're going to send out kind of these, like, what I call postmodern prayer cards, and they're really just kind of reflections of poetry with a piece of art on the other side. We're going to use a talk from our two podcasts from now. Emily Britt's conversation about God and the Greeks is going to be the first one of those. I'm really kind of excited, and I'm going to ask you if we can do this right now. I kind of want to do an extra one with next week. We're going to talk to Brad Hudson, and he kind of has this challenge at the end that he puts out for atheists. But I think it'd be a really good modification to just modify that to be kind of a maxim for our podcast and go like the Hudson maxim, because that'll sound
The Hudson maxim.
That's going to sound really important and impressive to people. And so we'd send people a copy of that also, which I would sum up. No, I'm not going to sum up. You got to listen to the next one. It's at the very end. If you can't wait, go to like the 45-minute mark and move forward. But he puts out a challenge to atheists that I just think is a great challenge to everybody. And then there's some higher levels where you get other stuff. But it's a great way just to support these type of conversations. So there's all those different ways. We would love to have you guys support. We would love to have you guys connecting with us online. Father Parrish, is there anything you want to say to people before we go?
Yeah. I think that, you know, this kind of podcast, I think, is hugely important, and particularly within my own heart, I just want to see the success of it. So, you know, like, supporting us is basically walking a journey with us, right? So it's a very material way of helping us walk a road together. Yeah. And I just invite you to that if you feel so moved.
And I would say, if you're the kind of person who just doesn't have money to give, doesn't want to give money, really what we would love is if you would just share the podcast with other people. Share us our post on Facebook, encourage other people to like and subscribe. That really, actually, more than any sort of financial support that you can give, is really important, because it actually lets us engage with you and others in dialogue, which is what this is all about. So until the next time we get together, get out there, FNF ability, and talk about what really matters.
Ciao.